Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. It turns out a lot of pressure can be a good thing. BP says it is monitoring pressure levels on its cap that has, for the first time in nearly 3 months, stopped the flow of millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Engineers say high levels of pressure are a sign that the oil is not seeping into the seabed. This morning, President Obama cautioned that while the cap is good news, we're not out of the woods yet.
We won't be done until we actually know that we've killed the well and that we have a permanent solution in place. We're moving in that direction, but I don't want us to get too far ahead of ourselves.
So what are the risks, and how far away is a permanent solution? For more on that, we turn to Henry Fountain, science reporter for The New York Times. Welcome back to Here and Now, Henry.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, to the risks, can you go into more detail about what exactly BP and government scientists are watching in terms of this pressure?
Yeah, they're really looking at whether the well can hold pressure for a significant amount of time. That would indicate that the well is not damaged way down, 13,000 feet below the seabed. So far, things look good. The pressure's actually risen beyond the point where they would have thought that the well was very badly damaged. So things are looking good so far, but it's going to take a while longer.
We actually have a live feed of the well at our website, hereandnow.org. And after weeks of seeing oil just gushing out of it, it's amazing to see that the oil has actually stopped. We read that if the oil goes into the seabed, however, it could be an even bigger catastrophe. Could you explain that and how that could possibly happen?
Yeah, that was the main fear in doing this test, that if the well was damaged, particularly closer to the seabed, that by closing the well off, closing these valves off and raising the pressure, it might end up damaging even further, and that oil and gas would bubble out of the well and into the rock just below the seabed and then force its way up into the water. So you'd have, in some ways, you'd have a much worse leak because you'd have more oil and gas coming into the water, and it'd be coming not through the well, but actually through the soil, through the ground. So that does not appear to have happened, and I would think at this point BP might be thinking that won't happen because pressures are pretty good right now.
So then, assuming the cap passes all of BP's tests, what are the options on the table? Will they shut off the oil, or will they simply collect it?
Well, that's been a subject of some confusion for the last few days. Some BP officials seem to say that, if the test was successful, they would just leave the valves closed, and that would stop the leak permanently until these relief wells are finished. Admiral Thad Allen, who's the national commander of the response effort, yesterday seemed to retreat on that and say, no, the intention was never to leave the well permanently closed, even if the test is successful, but perhaps leave it closed in if there's a hurricane and all the collection ships have to leave. But the plan seems to be, if the test is good, they would continue to collect the oil rather than shutting off the flow permanently.
So you mentioned hurricanes. The cap actually allows better options in the event of a hurricane.
Well, yeah. Without the cap, the plan was, in the event of a hurricane, because all the vessels on the surface have to leave, so you'd have an uncontrolled spill again in such a case. But with the cap, it seems like they'll be able to, if the test is successful, they might be able to leave the well totally closed during a hurricane, which would mean no leak at all.
As President Obama said, the cap is not a permanent solution, but the relief wells they are drilling are supposed to be. So tell us how far along BP is in that process.
Well, there's two relief wells. One was really meant as a backup all along, so it's doing fine. But the first relief well is actually very close to its target, which is 13,000 feet below the seabed. It's only about 5 feet away horizontally. It's maybe a couple hundred feet above vertically. And that seems like, well, gosh, you might think it's going to be done in a day. But in fact, at this point, it's a very slow process. They have to keep doing these ranging runs where they determine using electromagnetic tools where the damaged well is, and they have to be very careful because what they're trying to do is literally intersect that well, and the metal casing of the damaged well is only 7 inches in diameter, so it's a very small target. So they're still talking about end of July at the earliest, maybe mid-August to kill it, and that's That's without bad weather forcing them to leave. Once they do get the relief well intercepted, the procedure is, and it's been used many times, is to pump heavy drilling mud down the relief well, and it enters the damaged well way down at the bottom near the oil reservoir. And they keep pumping it in, and it slowly builds up above the oil, and at some point you get a column of this mud, this heavy material that has enough downward force that it counteracts the upward force of the oil and gas, and you've killed the well. And at that point, then you pump cement down, and you basically create a 13,000-foot column of cement that will stop the well forever. Mm.
Henry, you were recently on a Coast Guard cutter in the Gulf, about a mile from where all the action is. What's it like down there?
Well, it's a pretty amazing scene. If you like to look at large industrial structures and vessels and things, there's about 65 boats at the scene right now. There's everything from drilling rigs that are drilling these relief wells. They're the big vessels that have been collecting the oil and flaring it off, and they're now silent, but they may go back in operation. There's lots of support vessels. There's, all those live feeds that you can see are provided by submersibles that are supported by ships, and there's probably 7 or 8 of these support ships there at this point. So it's quite the scene, particularly at night when everything's lit up. It's like, it's like a floating city on the horizon. It's really something.
Henry, thank you very much for the update this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Fountain is a science reporter for The New York Times, speaking to us about BP's cap that has, for the moment, stopped the oil from gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. Now to a very different kind of story about domestic violence. No one expected Catherine Stewart's life to turn out the way that it did. Not her parents, not her friends, nor her teachers, and especially not Catherine herself.
The last thing anyone who knew Catherine growing up would have predicted would have been that she would find herself thrown through the air across her kitchen by her husband, the object of a rage that could only be called murderous. In fact, it would have been so far from their imagining that it wouldn't have been the last thing. But no thing at all, not even occurring to them to rank below the rest.
That's Alan Johnson reading from The First Thing and the Last, his book about the horrors of domestic violence and the healing needed to help victims reclaim their lives. First, a warning here that we're about to enter a topic that may not be appropriate for children. Alan Johnson is a sociologist who's published nearly a half dozen nonfiction works, including books on race, gender, and other forms of social inequality. But The First Thing and the Last is his first novel, one that Publishers Weekly called a moving, engaging read. Oprah Winfrey's O Magazine listed it as one of its great reads. Alan Johnson joins us now in our studio.
Thank you.
Who is Catherine Stewart, and what happened to her?
She is an intelligent, well-educated, sensitive, artistic woman who falls in love with a man who is charming, attentive to her. What she does not realize is that beneath that is an obsession with control that eventually takes the form of violence, but when it's too late.
And on the surface, her husband, David, seems decent enough. He's educated. He lovingly courts Catherine. Mm-hmm. He appears to be a good father to his young son, Nathan. He plays with him, reads to him. But when David drinks, he loses his mind. Tell me, where do men like David come from?
David is, in many ways, is a typical man. Not in the sense that I'm saying that the typical man beats up women, but that he has an obsession with control. So David is a man who takes this to an extreme. And he resorts to physical and verbal violence. And what people who've worked with batterers have found is that the obsession with control is so intense that when they feel that control threatened, especially when women do what everyone says they're supposed to do, which is they try to leave, that men experience what these workers have called a fatal peril. They really feel endangered, as if they're going to die if they can't maintain this control. And that the violence acts as a kind of restorative for them. And so David is not crazy. He's not a monster. He is resorting to violence in order to accomplish what I think he believes every man is supposed to be able to demonstrate, which is that he's in control of his woman.
Why didn't Catherine leave?
One of the main reasons, the most immediate reason that women don't leave is that they can't. They don't have the money. They have children, small children perhaps. They have nowhere to go. They don't have money to rent an apartment. And if they did, they wouldn't be safe, which is the second big reason, is they're frightened to go. The time when a woman is most likely to be murdered by her abusive spouse is when she tries to leave. When women choose to stay in these situations, they're making a rational choice based upon their security needs and the security needs of their children.
In your book, Catherine did try to leave David once.
Yes.
She goes to her parents' home, obviously beaten, seeking help. Her mother essentially blames her for this. David shows up. Her husband shows up. Her father does nothing. They mm-hmm. just lets him take her and his grandson away. I mean, is denial a common reaction from the outsiders who are looking in?
I think denial is as epidemic as domestic violence is. I think families are so much wanting these things to go away, for them not to be true, that they even turn out family members who are at risk. This happens with sexual abuse. Very often when the person who's been sexually abused brings it up in the family, they get attacked by the family for creating conflict and distress. There's just a massive amount of denial, and I think part of the reason for that is there is such a strong perception that families in which this happens are bad and that the women are somehow deserve this. There's something flawed in them, so there's a tremendous amount of shame.
David takes Catherine back home after this. Mm-hmm. He threatens to kill her and Ethan if she ever leaves again. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Catherine knows there's no safety anywhere anymore.
Yes.
That all the years of trying to contain her husband's rage, try to shelter her son, mm-hmm. it's over.
Yes. I mean, I think there is a moment when Catherine realizes that she's being held prisoner. And this is a very common theme in domestic violence situations. So it's not just a matter of violent actions, you know, I slap you or I throw a plate at you or something. But what we're talking about here is a whole pattern where women are literally held prisoners in their homes, and very often with the children held hostage.
Alan, you describe Catherine's plight in a paragraph that closes Chapter 3 of the book. Can you read that for us?
Yes, be happy to. Her sole refuge became a numb and frozen place inside herself where time and feeling stopped, suspended above her body while he beat or raped her, focused only on the simple goal of staying alive from one moment to the next, deflecting the blow, stanching the flow of blood, presenting the smallest possible target, saying nothing that might fuel what raged all about her, wondering if Ethan could hear, and praying that he would stay in his room just one more time.
So this abuse of Catherine continues until one fateful night of unspeakable violence that changes everything, Alan. What happened?
David's rage escalates beyond what it had ever been before, and Ethan comes downstairs against Catherine's prayers that he stay upstairs, and he can't resist because he thinks there's something wrong. Of course there is, and he comes downstairs, and Catherine asks David to give Ethan to her. And he does by picking Ethan up and throwing him across the kitchen. And then he realizes what he's done, and he comes after Catherine to annihilate her. And by some chance, she is able to kill him before he kills her.
Alan Johnson, author of The First Thing and the Last, his debut novel about domestic violence. It's the story of Catherine Stewart, who after years of abuse kills her husband David after a night of horrific violence that leaves her badly beaten and her son Ethan dead at the hands of his father. Alan, as Catherine is recovering from her wounds, she meets an elderly woman who has read a newspaper account of what happened to Catherine. She shows up unannounced in Catherine's hospital room. This is Lucy Dudley, who convinces Catherine to come and live with her. And as we learn, Lucy and Catherine have much in common.
Yes, and Lucy comes from a family farm where she lives by herself in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, and reads about Catherine and literally comes after her, even though she doesn't really know why she's going down there until she gets there.
And there's a scene that really sums up what Lucy is able to give to Catherine. Set that up for us and read the last bit of that scene.
Yeah. Lucy is providing a place where Catherine can rediscover who she is, can discover what hasn't been taken from her irrevocably. and begin to reclaim those smallest choices that are wrapped in fear if you're in a domestic violence situation. And she notices that Catherine doesn't take any baths, and Lucy just has an old clawfoot tub looking out over the hills, and Catherine tells her a story of her husband trying to drown her in the tub, and she never took a bath after that. So Lucy says, all right, I have an idea, and takes her upstairs and draws the bath. And so in this little part here, Catherine is lying in the bathtub, and Lucy is reading to her from Annie Dillard's A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Catherine sinks down, closing her eyes, and for just a moment feels safe in the arms of the old woman sitting by the door. She drifts into half-sleep and then opens her eyes to the sound of Lucy's voice and bubbles breaking in the cool air above the tub. Lucy, she says, in a sleepy voice. Yes, dear. Would you open the door a little? Of course. How are you doing in there? Fine. There is a long silence, and then, Lucy, Catherine's eyes beginning to fill. What? How did you get to be the way you are? One bath at a time, honey. One bath at a time.
What's the connection between these women?
Oh, I think Lucy is the grandmother crone archetype. She comes in to rescue Catherine from hell. And of course, Lucy has a history of her own around this. She knows a lot about what Catherine's been through, and she also knows she can't save her.
And it's clear that Lucy needs Catherine as much as Catherine needs Lucy.
Yes.
And this is because Lucy has a secret.
Yes.
That she's been reluctant to tell even Catherine.
Yes. In some ways, she is waiting for Catherine so that she can tell her things that she hasn't dared tell anyone else.
Early on in the novel, as David's abuse of Catherine is beginning, he finds and he burns a collection of poems that Catherine has written over the years, and she is totally devastated by this. It destroys her in a way that rivals the physical abuse. And it's interesting in Vermont, when she's with Lucy and she's slowly healing, Catherine starts writing again.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how important it is for people who have been abused to go back and to reclaim something that's been taken away from them by their abuser.
Domestic violence is all about literally taking away people's lives. And David burning Catherine's poetry is a kind of attempted soul murder. So in a sense, his obsession with control, the counterpart to that is her complete lack of control over anything, inner or outer, in her life. So an essential part of post-traumatic stress disorder is this sense of danger can come from any direction at any moment, so there's no place for you to settle down inside yourself.
Right.
There's no stillness. There's no quiet space, including a space in which to create something of beauty. And so for Catherine, that came out in her poetry. And so her halting beginning attempts with Lucy's encouragement to simply re-encounter those parts of herself that she might experience again with some autonomy.
This novel feels so real and so authentic, and I know that's the reaction that you get from people.
Yes.
Publishers Weekly, in describing your novel, The First Thing and the Last, called the prose, quote, lyrical, the characters sympathetic, the story convincing. But it took you 7 years, Alan, to get this novel published.
Yeah.
You were rejected by 60 publishers. What did they tell you when they turned you down?
Well, a lot of them just tell you, you know, little reasons that they just make use of when they don't know what else to say to you. But the most consistent, repeated response was that they had a problem with the violence. They would say things like, the violence was a little too real for me, which I have to say as an artist, that totally throws me. I don't understand what they're saying, because we work very hard to be able to write things that ring true.
I guess that's the ultimate compliment.
That's the ultimate compliment, and that's their reason for rejecting it.
We don't want to give the ending away, but in the end, how do you see your novel? Is it a tragic story? Is it a hopeful story? And in what ways do you see Catherine's story resonating beyond her personal struggles?
Well, there are aspects to it that are terrible and tragic. I will never get over what happened to Ethan. And life is full of such things. They happen to people all the time. For Catherine, I feel that things are possible. What's possible in the wake of such terrible things? And the answer is something, not nothing. And Lucy is the one who helps her to see that. Lucy doesn't solve anything for Catherine. She doesn't save her, but Lucy allows Catherine to see that something is possible here. She will never be the same again. She will never get back what was taken from her. And a life is possible.
Alan Johnson is author of The First Thing and the Last, his debut novel about domestic violence. By the way, where did the title come from?
My favorite poet, Jane Kenyon. It's a poem called Walking with the Dog at Sunrise, about trying to figure out what to say to a young friend whose husband has died and is in grief. And the line from the poem is, searching for God is the first thing and the last, but in between, such trouble, such pain.
For more on The First Thing and the Last, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Alan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Next week on Here and Now, Hardwick, Vermont is booming, driven by a local food movement. The irony is the locals can't afford to buy the food. We speak with a farmer journalist about the lessons. News is next, Here and Now. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is expected to take the stand in his own defense next week when his federal corruption trial resumes in Chicago. The prosecution rested its case this week. They're out to prove that Blagojevich tried to shake down a hospital executive, a racetrack owner, the Chicago Tribune, and that he tried to sell or trade the U.S. Senate seat held by Barack Obama before he became president. The evidence includes secret wiretap recordings like this one, where Blagojevich talks about the value of the Senate seat.
I've got this thing, and it's golden, and I'm just not giving it up for nothing.
Elsewhere on the tapes, Blagojevich bashes other politicians, reporters, the voters of Illinois, even his wife, Patty. Jeff Cohen is covering the trial for the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Jeff, as you write, these recordings are jaw-dropping, but are they criminal?
Well, that's going to be the question for the jury, because a lot of the deals that we hear Rod Blagojevich talking about in these tapes were not completed. So you have the prosecution on one side saying that these are examples of criminal scheming where he's plotting to either fundraise illegally or get something of value for himself for the Senate seat. But you have the defense on the other hand saying that nothing really happened and that this is just Blagojevich spouting off and thinking out loud and talking to his aides about political strategy versus anything real that would put money in his pocket, and nothing ever came of it. So we'll see what the jury does with that.
Is the prosecution trying to create a framework here with these tapes for the jurors to try to understand motive here, why Rob Blagojevich might have done such a thing?
Yeah, I think it's that, and just there are so many tapes that they want the jury to get a full picture of what was going on behind the scenes. I think that it's a lot for the jury to handle. There are a lot of different schemes that are in play here, but just through this sheer volume of tapes, they're hoping to give the jury a sense of what Blagojevich was about, that this wasn't just one or two incidents where he's, you know, kind of in a corner talking to somebody, that this was sort of a pervasive strategy with him.
What else jumped out at you as the prosecution made its case, Jeff?
You know, one thing that really jumped out at us was another thing that wasn't really on the criminal side, but it was just how little actual governing Blagojevich seemed to be doing at some stretches of his administration. There was a lot of testimony from aides that were close to him who basically said that at times they couldn't find him. He, you know, supposedly hid in the bathroom from his budget director at one point, and he had a very young deputy governor who found himself in the position of deciding on vetoes and whether pending legislation should be signed just because Blagojevich couldn't be found. And it turns out he was often at his campaign office or even at his house running this kind of business.
Well, lawyers for Blagojevich say that these secret recordings will help make their case that he, in fact, is not guilty. Do we know what's on those tapes that would help that cause?
Interestingly enough, it's some of the same stuff. It's just Blagojevich kind of running at the mouth on all these different alleged schemes. And what they're going to do is just turn that on its head and say a lot of these aides that he's talking to are lawyers, and he's actually talking to a lot of people who are lawyers who are close to him, and nobody is stopping him and saying, hey, you're way out of bounds here. What you're doing is wrong. They want to say that that shows that the governor had no intent to commit any kind of a crime. He's surrounding himself with lawyers, and he's bouncing this idea off him, especially in the Senate seat, and nobody's telling him that what he's doing is wrong.
So what else are you expecting from the defense when it begins making its case next week?
Well, we'll have the Blagojevich brothers on the stand trying to explain themselves, and then we also are expecting a group of national political figures to be called, or there's going to be an attempt to call them by the Blagojevich defense. That's going to include probably most notably Rahm Emanuel, who the Blagojevich folks say acted as an emissary on one of the deals that wasn't charged for the Senate seat, which sounds much more like it was political horse trading, and that Blagojevich used the manual to take messages to Illinois political figures on that deal. And their point is that if that political deal weren't the one that he was actually going to do, then why would he bring Rahm Emanuel into that picture? So he's got that one as opposed to, say, you know, appointing Jesse Jackson Jr. in exchange for campaign money.
Of course, the main event will be the testimony of Blagojevich himself. I imagine that can only add to what seems like a circus atmosphere outside the courtroom anyway.
Yeah, that is absolutely going to bump this to another level as he gets up there and sort of tries to, some would say, talk his way out of this, which he seems to try to do whenever there's a microphone nearby anyway. But this will be the real deal.
Well, Jeff Cohen is covering the Rod Blagojevich corruption trial for the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in 30 seconds with a check-in on Africa, where in the wake of post-World Cup soccer euphoria, terror has been the story this week. It's here and now. Soccer euphoria and terror have been stories this week from Africa. South Africa pulled off what were by any measure wildly successful World Cup soccer games, defying the country's and the continent's reputation for violent crime, poverty, and AIDS. But before the continent could celebrate, bombs ripped through crowds watching the championship game in faraway Uganda, killing over 70 people. The militant group, the militant Islamic group Al-Shabaab, which is based in Somalia, claimed responsibility, saying the bombs were in retaliation against Ugandan troops in Somalia. Those troops are there on a mission from the African Union. There are also fears of violence over a new constitution in Kenya and an upcoming referendum in Sudan to split the country in half. But underneath, Africa's economy is growing faster than America's. So where is Africa after the World Cup? With us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, is Peter Gresta, East Africa correspondent for the BBC. Peter, what's the latest on the bombing in Uganda?
Well, there's been a lot of belligerent talk since that attack. The Ugandan government, the Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, has pledged to move as many as 2,000 more troops into Somalia in defiance of Al-Shabaab, basically demonstrating his refusal to be cowed by that attack. At the same time, just late yesterday, Al-Shabaab issued a statement saying that they would carry out still more attacks if, in fact, the Ugandans refused to withdraw all their troops.
Talk more about Somalia, if you would, Peter. What are Ugandan troops doing there, along with, we understand, troops from Burundi?
They're there to help support the transitional federal government. This is a government that's been in power for just over 2 years now, and it's been squeezed into a very, very small corner of Mogadishu. In fact, it's a strategic, fairly strategic corner. They control the port, the airport, the presidential palace and so on. But that is, frankly, about it. Without the African Union troops, it's almost certain that the government would fall to Al-Shabaab, which controls the vast bulk of the rest of the city and indeed most of southern and central Somalia. Al-Shabaab and a number of other critics, not just Al-Shabaab, have accused the Ugandans for being particularly brutal in their exchanges. Every time they come under attack, they tend to respond with artillery. And, of course, artillery is a particularly indiscriminate weapon. It's very difficult to avoid civilian casualties when you're firing into civilian areas to try and hit a few snipers, a few people that might be firing RPGs. So Al-Shabaab is angry and has used that to win a lot of support.
Al-Shabaab also has some interesting parallels with the Taliban in Afghanistan. What are they?
I was in Afghanistan back in 1995 when the Taliban first emerged. And, you know, since I've been working here, those parallels have really been very, very striking indeed. I think in both cases, what happened was that these movements were formed as local movements as a response to the kind of lawlessness and terror that we saw warlords wreaking on both Somalia and Afghanistan. In both cases, they adopted Sharia law, Islamic law, as the most readily available, the most potent, the most useful form of law and order that they could, that they had at their disposal. Now, of course, that wasn't particularly palatable to the West, but in both cases there was a very vigorous internal debate between the moderates and the extremists. And I think there was a period, again, both in Afghanistan and Somalia, when we saw those movements reaching out to the wider international community, looking for support and recognition. And when it didn't come from the West, it created the space and the opportunity for the extremists to move in and radicalize those forces. Again, both in Afghanistan and now in Somalia, there are two factions, if you like. There are the locals who desperately want to see Sharia law imposed locally, And there are the foreigners who have got a much more global jihadi agenda. And that, I think, is the key in Somalia. Those radicals from outside really want to see Somalia, I think, destabilized and use that as a platform for attacking the region, attacking the neighbors, and provoking the kind of response that I think we're likely to see with the African Union sending more troops in.
Peter, isn't there one difference between al-Shabaab and the Taliban in that the al-Shabaab cannot raise as much money or the same amount of money as the Taliban?
And that is a very crucial difference. Somalia has very little in the way of natural resources. Afghanistan is, of course, the world's biggest supplier by a very wide margin of heroin, of opium. But I have to say, I suspect that we haven't heard the last of al-Shabaab, and I think Somalia is likely to become a much bigger problem unless the international community mobilizes and starts to think very seriously about it.
Ugandan President Museveni has vowed to crush al-Shabaab. He says he wants to send more troops to Somalia and widen their mandate. African heads of state are going to be in Kampala soon for a meeting of the African Union. Will they give the Ugandan president, do you think, a bigger mandate in Somalia?
That is going to be a very interesting summit, isn't it? I think they're really torn. They would find it very, very difficult not to accept those calls from President Museveni, particularly when he will be hosting this meeting. He will be the main man, if you like. But at the same time, those calls have been out there for a very long time for other African states to contribute troops. And after Afghanistan, I think Somalia is, with almost without doubt, the most dangerous place on the planet, particularly for foreign forces. And it is going to be a very, very tough president indeed. He'll go back from this summit to his own country to say, we are committing more troops into the front lines in Somalia to join the fight there.
Let me ask you about Kenya, which is where you're talking to us from. It came close to civil war after presidential elections, as you know, in 2008. 1,000 people died. Now the country is facing a referendum on its new constitution this August. There has already been violence around that referendum. How do you see that shaping up?
You know, we've had, up until now, this conversation has been pretty depressing. Talk of war and conflict and bombings and so on. And I have to say that I think there is a pretty good chance that these elections, this referendum, might buck that trend, that we may actually see the referendum pass off reasonably peacefully. But this is only half of the story. The implementation of that constitution is also another very big part of it, as well as whether or not the country is able to move forward on prosecutions that it has promised for those people who were directly responsible for the violence in the last elections.
Peter, what about this economic pact that the major East African countries recently signed? It forms something of an EU for the region. The economic story in Africa is actually better than most people imagine, with the continent seeing growth of about 5%. It's better than we're doing in the United States or Europe, for
yes.
that matter.
Yeah, it is something for you guys to admire and
exactly.
look forward to, isn't it?
Well, some of it actually is being driven by things like cell phones.
Yeah, this is really interesting, and this is another of the regional success stories. You're absolutely right. The phone itself has become a bank. There is a new service which was launched a few months back, allowing you to run your bank account entirely with your cell phone, to move money around from person to person, also from cell phone to cell phone. You don't have to have an address. You don't have to have anything more than a standard identity card for you to be able to use this service. And it has absolutely astonished the observers to see just how this technology has taken off. And it has had a remarkable effect on the sheer volumes of money that are now moving around the economy. That alone is responsible for a pretty sizable proportion of the economic growth that we've just been talking about.
Fascinating. Peter, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Peter Gresta, East Africa correspondent for the BBC.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. It's been an interesting week in sports. Some young guys are topping the leaderboard at golf's British Open. A South African runner is back on the track after accusation that she is actually a he. And a Tour de France cyclist is ejected for headbutting. Here to explain it all is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Welcome, Bill.
I can't explain all these things.
Okay. We got 3 minutes.
Sports
30
is supposed
seconds.
To be simple.
Okay. Let's go to the British Open in Scotland first. A windy day today in the second round, right? Tell us about these young guys at the top being chased by these players you'd expect to be winning. Tiger Woods, John Daly.
Absolutely. Mr. Wustuizen of South Africa is having himself a heck of a tournament. And, of course, the biggest story story at the British Open is wind, and it's not wind which is preventing people from hitting the ball straight when they drive off the tee. Apparently, the big issue is that if you step up to address your ball when it's on the green and the wind moves it, you are penalized. So if you haven't stepped up to address your ball yet and the wind moves it, you are not penalized. Now, this is golf. It's why more arcane rules than all other sports put together. But anyway, I believe that play has begun again and all is well in Scotland.
All right, good. So then let's turn to the South African running phenom, Caster Semenya. She is back on the track again.
Right. Happily, she is. She performed well on Thursday. She will run again on Sunday, and her coach and others in her camp are saying that she will probably run even more successfully on Sunday. It's rather low-key comeback by design.
So this is the runner who broke record after record in the 800-meter, drew attention for her very muscular build after some competitors complained that she was actually not female. Now she's been cleared to compete against women.
Exactly right, and I think legitimately. So one of the things that's come out of this case is the impossibility of simply saying yes or no, black or white, male or female. These are not simple distinctions to make with DNA or anything else. So she's once again begun her running career, and more power to her.
All right. In the Tour de France, we understand that a cyclist has been ejected for, drumroll, headbutting.
Shouldn't he be given some sort of award? How can you headbutt somebody while you're riding
That's
40
talent.
Miles an
I
hour on a
you.
Bicycle? I think he ought to get some sort of, you know, if not a yellow jersey, perhaps a red jersey. I don't know, something.
All right. Major League Baseball's All-Star Game had a surprising result, Bill. The National League beat the American League for the first time in more than a decade?
Yes, never happens. The interesting thing about the second half of the season, of course, as we get beyond the All-Star break, is there's a fascinating race, I think, set up in the National League West, where there are four teams within a game and a half of each other. I love that. Boston's problem, of course, will be that they've got two teams playing very good baseball in front of them, and a roster which is unsure from hour to hour, let alone game to game, because they've had more injuries than anybody else in baseball, as fans in Boston know all too well, mm-hmm, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. Before tonight's Yankee game and New York Yankees game, they'll pay tribute to longtime Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, mm-hmm, and legendary announcer Bob Shepard, named the voice of God. Put these two losses, big losses, into context for
us. Would you like to hear my Bob Shepard imitation?
Please.
Now batting for the Yankees, Willie Randolph. Second base, Willie Randolph. It's about as good as I can do it. George Steinbrenner, of course, was given credit, legitimately so, for presiding over lots of championship teams. Weirdly enough, most of those teams assembled while he was under suspension for various trespasses against Major League Baseball and the laws of man. But so goes the irony of baseball and beyond.
Bill Littlefield, always thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally today, one last sports-related story. When Babe Ruth played for the Boston Red Sox, he owned a cabin on Willis Pond in nearby Sudbury, Massachusetts. The year was 1918, and as legend has it, during a raucous wintertime party, Ruth pushed his piano onto the frozen pond and played it while his friends sang and danced the night away. He left the piano there, and come spring thaw, it fell to the bottom. For decades, treasure hunters like Kevin Kennedy have been trying to find it. Kennedy joins me now from his home on Willis Pond. He says he's getting close. Hi, Kevin. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Tell us what you found earlier this summer.
We're quite excited. We had a dive on June 20th, and we took up what looked like a piece of plywood, but actually we found out later that it actually was a piece of piano veneer.
And why do you believe this piece of wood is from Babe Ruth's piano?
Sure enough, the least likely thing that I thought would have been a piano, which basically looked like a piece of plywood, turns out to be piano veneer. I took that to an expert three times, and I had to listen each time. I just couldn't believe my ears. And if that was not enough, I followed up with a wood expert who I didn't tell anything to. I just said, I'm here for you to look at this piece of wood. It was one of the smallest pieces of veneer. I was looking to see if he could identify the type of wood it was, and he carried it in his hand. He's looking at it. He says, well, I don't know what type it is, but it's piano veneer. And I said, how did you know that? I was ecstatic. And, of course, then he looked at me and he said, why is it wet? I had to explain the whole story, which he didn't hear about, which kind of surprised me.
So this particular piece of wood, it's very stylish. It comes from that period, from the turn of the century into the 1920s?
Why it's so unique is the thickness of the veneer, and that's why Lee Swanson of the Sudbury Historical Society almost knew immediately what it was also when it came up after he looked at it a little bit. And this person had that I took it to, this wood expert, said the same thing, and that he remembered taking a piano apart when he was a younger man and realized how thick. It's very unusual. It's very special to pianos, I guess, the thickness of the veneer.
So you found what you believe is a piece of Ruth's piano. What's next?
We're actually looking at four different spots. We're looking for a pin block, which attaches the wire. We're looking for the keyboard. We have found, by accident, veneer from probably the cabinet, and the prize of them all would be the harp.
Well, right. You've located it, but you haven't yet recovered it. Is that right?
We think we've located it. What we need now is the next step to the permitting, because this is all in the up and up, will be to hire a underwater archaeologist who specializes in this type of retrieval and this type of research to come out and to positively identify it as a piano harp. And when that happens, we go for an excavation permit with the state of Massachusetts, and we're allowed to bring it up at that point.
Well, if you recover the harp, which is the soul of this piano, you say you plan to restore Babe Ruth's piano and give a final swan song to the babe. Do you have a tune in mind for that?
I do. People have told me that this is a Sisyphean task of finding the piano in a pond that's 70 acres and murky and muddy. Some people have called it a fool's errand, and some people have described me as chasing rainbows, and I think I like that. I've been chasing rainbows, but at the end of one rainbow I found, I think, the veneer to Babe Ruth's upright piano, and I hope the other rainbow has a harp that we could play the tune. I think it would be appropriate. I'm always chasing rainbows, I guess.
I can see him on the piano in my mind's eye right now.
That's wonderful, isn't it, Jane?
Kevin Kennedy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Kennedy is a resident of Sudbury, Massachusetts. He's on a quest to find the piano that Babe Ruth reportedly let sink into Willis Pond in 1918. We'll leave you with one of that year's big hits, one Ruth may have played on his piano. This is Bud Powell's version of Charles Harrison's appropriately titled, I'm Always Chasing Rainbows. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Jane Clayson, and have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.